Joyce Moy, the Executive Director of the Asian American Asian Research Institute at the City University of New York, otherwise known as ARI, because that name is just too long. We thought about looking at Flushing from a slightly different point of view, because Flushing is, as many of you know, the largest Chinatown, so-called Chinatown, in New York City at this time. And the community has continued to change over the years. And I wanted to just kind of frame it for you a little bit before we talk about the specifics that are laid out in this particular presentation. You know, my grandfather owned a Chinese hand laundry in Flushing, right behind the area that this study covers. And so there has been an Asian presence in that area, primarily Chinese, but very small. And I grew up walking through the area and seeing all of the changes that took place. While that happened, the older Queens community, sometimes we call it Old Queens, really found it hard to adjust to the changes that were being made. After the immigration law was changed and larger numbers of the Asian American community started to come to the United States, the pressure on real estate in Lower Manhattan began to grow. And in the 1980s, just before Hong Kong was returned to China formally, there was a lot of capital flight out of Hong Kong. And that again started to put pressure on the price of real estate and accessibility of real estate in Manhattan's Chinatown. The city actually then began to deliberately steer and guide people towards Flushing. One of the reasons for it was because Flushing was on a major decline at that point. If you walk through the neighborhood as I did, there were many, many vacant stores. Crime was on the rise in the area. And Flushing was the last stop on the number 7 train, which is now called the International Express, because of all of the ethnic communities that exist along that particular line. But back in the 80s, that was not so. As a matter of fact, in the 70s, if you went through Flushing, you would see that Main Street, which is the primary commercial corridor in Flushing, was actually like a little Main Street. The kind of Main Street you would find in the Midwest somewhere. You'd see the barber shops with the red, white, and blue light that spun around. There was Malkin's button shop. There was Amer's butcher shop. It was like the little picture of middle American Main Street. But then the influx of people began to come in from Asia, and that really caused a tremendous change. It turned the commercial strip around. Actually, I would say that Flushing owed its resurgence and revitalization to the Asian populations that came in. It was the Chinese, the Koreans, and at one point there was a fairly large Indian population in that area, and that population moved a little further towards the city, towards Manhattan rather, and with it went the State Bank of India and some of the cultural shops and so on that were in Flushing at one point. So the changes brought a lot of unsettled feelings among the old timers of Queens, and there was a lot of discussion that went on in the late 80s, early 90s. I was part of a task force at that time that was led by Councilman John Liu's office. He was the first Asian American elected to citywide office in New York City. And he convened a meeting with the African American community, the old Queens, old white Queens community, as well as the Latino community that was there, and the emerging Asian American leaders to talk about how we work together and how we could solve some of the misinterpretations, the kinds of things that were happening. There was one woman who complained to me that she had gone into one of the Asian stores, and the young lady behind the counter said this. She just made these motions like, no, 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 no. And the woman said, she obviously didn't want my business, so I left. And I said to her, I don't think that's what happened. What she was trying to tell you was that she did not speak English. And it wasn't that she didn't want your business, she didn't speak English. And she was being practical so that you understood. And there were all sorts of misunderstandings like that happening. And so again, there was an attempt to bridge the gap and make sure that people began to understand each other. And today, those kinds of interactions continue and in fact may play a role in terms of the relationships that are being built in these communities. Oftentimes, these ethnic communities do not meet in any other environment. The business environment may be the only time they actually encounter one another. They don't go to the same religious organizations, they don't belong to the same social clubs, business clubs, and so on. The chambers of commerce are separate. And so this can, in fact, play a major role in what happens in terms of the inter-ethnic relationships within those particular communities. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues. They are Michelle Wu, who is a professor at Hunter College, one of the CUNY campuses. And we have Youngmin So, who is a faculty member at LaGuardia Community College, one of our other CUNY campuses. And then we have Claire Chung, who is an outsider. She's from NYU, but she's being converted to an insider because she's an intern at ARI. So I'm going to turn it over to Mitch.
So as Joyce articulated in just from her own personal narratives and just growing up as a, you know, Flushing resident in New York City, you know, how dynamic Flushing is, right? So it kind of really leads us to really want to look at this community as the case study of the neighborhood that we want to look at for all these different particular wavelengths, interactions of interracial, interethnic, you know, and instances. So, I'm gonna really talk a little bit about the background of Flushing and Flushing's history. As you know, for the folks who do not know, you know, as Joyce mentioned earlier, that you know, if you go out to the end of that particular subway line, you know, a couple of decades ago, it looks like, you know, little town in, you know, in middle America, right? But actually, it's part of New York City, right? Flushing is in Queens, one of the boroughs in New York City, and just like New York City, it has a deep and very rich history. And so Flushing's history actually, let me go here, goes as far back as the 1600s. It was actually the Dutch that first came to settle in Flushing, and then with that, a lot of British also came. And in the mid-1600s, you had a lot of Quakers that also came, right? So, you know, if you go back to your history books, you know, the history of, you know, pilgrims coming to settle, searching for religious refuge and, you know, asylum and sanctity, right? They resided in, quote-unquote, these new colonies, right? So, you know, they settled in Boston and particularly also New York. Flushing, being geographically located where it is, it also is along, also is, can be seen as, of course, if there is the Flushing Creek and, that's there, and then people actually resided there, right, in this kind of northern kind of corner of Queens, New York City. And when they settled, you know, the Quakers actually, what they did was they actually issued kind of this actual document that expressed their right for religious freedom, right? So this is actually called the Flushing Remonstrance, right, signed in 1657. Okay, so this is way before, you know, 1776. This is way before the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. And so if you look at kind of the first picture here, actually, in 1957, right, you know, the postage office, the United States, you know, the federal government actually issued this commemorative stamp for this first kind of document that expressed the right to exercise religious, you know, freedoms, right, you know, civil liberties in that sense, right, and it was in Flushing, Queens, and not all places, right, so it does have that deep history. You know, if you actually walk down the streets now, you actually see remnants of that, right, so I'm just going to highlight that a little bit, you know, and kind of also tie it into kind of, you know, the community as it is now. It's actually, one of the pictures I put up there is actually something called the Fox Oaks Triangle, right, there's a little statue there. It actually commemorates, this, that was in 1660s, and it actually commemorates George Fox, who was actually one of the founders of the Quakers religion, and actually came and preached right in Flushing, right, again, really, you know, establishing kind of this site as a space where communities can come, right, and, you know, worship, you know, exercise their religious freedoms. the lower picture there is actually kind of like a copy of the old Flushing Monstrance actually document signed by the Quakers that actually signed them, you know, on that date. It's actually housed in Albany, New York. Right? This is the old Quaker meeting house, right? It was established in 1694, but erected in 1695, you see there. It's actually right there on one of the main commercial strips right now, still on Flushing. This is just another kind of like site. And these are all historical sites now, right? They're all deemed, you know, New York historical site, they're all preserved. So acknowledging kind of this actual physical space in Flushing. And to this day, it's one of the longest still operating places of worship in New York City. So, you know, they still, you know, have weekly meetings and so forth. So moving along, so that's kind of just the base, right? And moving along that, Flushing had its change in different communities coming and residing. You know, Joyce kind of just referenced a bit about, you know, post-65, right, in terms of the Asian influx. But before that, I just want to talk a little bit about also the turn of the century as well. If you go into the mid-1850s into the turn of the 1900s. So actually, this picture right there, I just want to mention real fast, that's actually the Main Street, right? And that's, you know, about 1940, during that time. Right, and so just a couple of things I want to highlight here is this is the old Flushing Town Hall. It is still in operation. It was a former town hall of a site where the Dutch actually met, right, when there was kind of this colonial outpost. Later on, it became, you know, when Flushing became incorporated part of New York City, it became like the Town Hall of Flushing, and now it acts as, it's still a historical preserve site, now it acts as an actual community and cultural center. Right, and if you go on there, they actually have galleries of Queens, not just Queens, but New York City jazz legends. One of the things also about Queens and the surrounding neighborhoods of Queens is that you had a lot of jazz musicians that resided there. So that leads to my next point is that, you know, when you get into the late mid-1800s, particularly in the early 1900s, Flushing actually was a vibrant hub of African-American community, right? There were heavy African-American, you know, families, working professionals, working-class professionals, white-collar folks that actually resided in Flushing and the surrounding areas and surrounding neighborhoods as well. Flushing High School is the lower right-hand corner there. That is actually the first New York City public high school in New York City, and it's also the historical site, right? So you have Flushing High School, Flushing Town Hall, right? And Flushing itself, you know, as this really historical place that has this huge legacy of asylum and refuge, right? In fact, Flushing is actually one of the major sites also of Underground Railroad, right? There is a restaurant right across the street from Flushing High School and down the street from Flushing Town Hall. It's a Korean restaurant, but and right in the basement, you still have old passages, right, of, you know, folks that when they were quartered, right, and, for safe passage, right, for the Underground Railroad. So there is that history as well. You know, Macedonian Church, that's there, that's been there for over 200 years, and that's one of the only remaining remnants of that community that's still there. There was a major strip in Flushing, but I have a map I'll show you guys as well. What happened was later on in the 1940s, the city imposed eminent domain and actually destroyed that part of where a lot of the storefronts were, that was owned by African-American small business owners, and developed a municipal parking lot, right, which is now Flushing Commons. And one of the sites that's still there that has not been touched is, you know, the old Macedonian
church. They built around that Macedonian church.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of legacy here, I mentioned, you know, pre-1776, even post-1716, yeah, people like George Washington visited Flushing, you know, at the Flushing Town Hall. Frederick Douglass even, you know, preached also at Flushing Town Hall as well. So there is that legacy again, right, of, again, refuge. But if you look at the community now, just some of the pictures I put up, this is kind of the image you see. This is, like, pretty much right around a lot of the historical sites that I just referenced in the previous slide. Okay, I'm going to quickly transition now to a quick snapshot of what Queens looks like now. So again, as mentioned by our director Joyce, you know, it is kind of, you know, kind of called the new Chinatown. But if you actually look at the demographics, it's, you know, it's, from a lot of people, they refer to it as Chinatown, right? But it's actually a huge Asian immigrant enclave, right? You know, from the late 70s on until now. And if you look at this now, this is a snapshot from data that was taken, you know, from one of the reports of our local CBLs, right, that actually that took census data and kind of reported it out. And you see the growth of the Asian population in Queens has grown exponentially compared to the other boroughs. And if you look at the bottom here, I just want to quickly just reference this part. Five of the seven major Asian neighborhoods where they flocked and resided to, where they got these numbers, you see number one, right, Flushing, Queensborough Hill, East Flushing, Elmhurst, Nassau, Morrow Hill, and you see. If you look, actually look at this map, this is downtown Flushing, right? And so these are where, you know, the Pilgrim, the Quakers, and the Dutch came and settled. The town hall is right here off of Northern Boulevard. The main street that we actually focus is here. This is the main street, and it cuts across this way. And all the other neighborhoods, Queensborough Hill, right, Elmhurst, that we mentioned earlier, Murray Hill, where it had, you know, increased exponential Asian residency and growth, are all the surrounding neighborhoods of Flushing as well. So Flushing actually became kind of this, you know, huge push and pull factor, more like the pull, right, site of a lot of Asian immigrants, right? And so if you look at it, it's actually, you know, if you even ask some of the residents there that are recent immigrants, like, you know, if they don't necessarily live in the, you know, quote-unquote, you know, jurisdiction of Flushing, but live right outside of it, you ask them where they live, they still say Flushing, right, because of the vicinity of where they're at to downtown Flushing. So there's this kind of huge kind of like cultural kind of definition also, right, of this region of what this place means for all these people coming here who are, you know, of Asian descent. And so just to give a little more to that, and then also turn over to one of our, you know, Claire from our research team.
Thank you, Mitch. So given this historical and social and economic context, which Mitch has laid out for us, it's really important considering and thinking about how Flushing has developed into this Asian immigrant enclave today. And, you know, so although we know New York City and New York City is heralded to be this incredibly diverse, rich city, the realities are that New York City continues to be one of the most segregated cities in the country, and actually Flushing happens to be one of the most segregated neighborhoods in New York City, along with, I believe, Staten Island, Brooklyn, and yes, yeah, the Bronx. And so considering the reality that, you know, given Flushing to be this incredibly rich, culturally diverse neighborhood, it continues to be siloed in these, in their respective racial and ethnic communities. And so what that prompted us to think about was, how then do individuals from other racial and cultural backgrounds come to interact with one another? And where do these interactions take place? And we hypothesized that these interactions are taking place in businesses, primarily retail stores, commercial stores, restaurants, and what that then asks though is, you know, in what ways are ideas and conceptions and perceptions of race and culture being formed through interactions between patrons and business owners? And so, given the density and development of the transit options in downtown Flushing, and particularly in the block that we're researching, this particular block happens to be incredibly unique in what it offers passersby. And that there's an incredibly diverse mix of land usage in which there's this heavily commercial background, but also it's a heavily dense transit hub as well. And so through in-depth interviews and ethnographic observations, our research seeks to better understand how racial attitudes and cultural perceptions of others are formed. and how these interactions, encounters between individuals across different racial ethnic lines contributes to sort of a larger construction of race and culture and these perceptions. And so the purpose of our qualitative and quantitative data collection is twofold. The first being to track and record the movements and developments of the commercial landscape of this urban Flushing, in which we frequented Flushing regularly over the course of 4 months, noting which businesses were changing, which new ones were developing. The second purpose was to gauge sort of general perceptions that people who were frequenting Flushing had. And this was done through surveys and through interviews in which we asked individuals, you know, what do you do when you come to Flushing? What do you buy? How long are you here for? How often do you come visit? And what our data reveals, which we'll go into later, is kind of key in understanding how these interactions and how these habits that people exhibit in this particular area contribute to sort of how they start to think about other groups and other cultures. And so this is the strip that we conducted our research on. It runs along Roosevelt Avenue from Main Street to Union Street. And you can just sort of see just by this Google Maps screenshot how diverse the sort of the types of businesses and stores are. I mean, you have electronic stores, there are clothing stores, there are restaurants, and there are actually a lot of smaller stores and businesses that aren't shown because they're changing so frequently and they're constantly, and there's such a high turnover rate. And even within these buildings themselves, there's multiple sort of vendors that are existing inside. And so this then kind of is what shaped our methodology, and that we wanted to have a very sort of diverse sort of approach to how we collected our data. And as I was saying before, we did a combination of surveys, ethnographic observations. We also enlisted students from Young Men's class to help in the interview process. His students also came from a very diverse background of racial and cultural groups, and so that also impacted the data that we collected and the individuals that we had access to. And then Young Men as well also conducted personal interviews with business owners and pedestrians, which she'll go on to explain.
I just don't have a sort of time. This is, you know, the actual, you know, the pictures of, you know, the U.S. city. You know, the four intersections, south side, east side, north and south. So I just thought, you know, let you feel what you're, you know, dealing with in our, you know, the research. This is a huge, you know, the mall, about, you know, the 30 or so, you know, the small stores inside, including gigantic, you know, the Chinese supermarket and also the food court. And west side. And this is my treat to you guys. One of my, you know, student, he is actually a professional YouTuber and made this, you know, the YouTube video. It's about 10 minutes.
You look so good, fantastic man.
8 months of study, I find out, many, the interactions. I'm an anthropologist, and the my methodology is obviously ethnography. So the initial, the contact and the making, the acquaintance with the people, participant observation, which led me to the friends of friends, and to know the neighbors. So as title indicate, our study is on the racial, inter-ethnic relations. Do I see the racism? Of course I do, daily basis. Yet that the discussion amongst ourselves is more likely on the personal or individual racism. This 8 months of the study, I have a very limited the time to engage any deeper the study. However, I would say I don't see many the incident of institutional racism. I just want to to remind you guys what it means by the institutional racism, against the business elites and police bias, and of course the school discrimination. And as I as time goes along, I will keep on mentioning further the research needed. However, here the case, I don't see many of those the incidents. And daily contact is another stuff. And the racial ethnic stereotype plays a big role. And if you guys come from New York, it's quite different the place, universal to itself. And we are very proud to root and Virgo, right? So that plays on also interpersonal relation, maybe a little bit tense, perhaps. And yet, over the course of, it's not just 8 months of study. I myself am, the New Yorker. I lived in, the Flushing area, even though it's just 1 year, 1996 to 1997. I see the, some changes. Gradual, slow, yet certain changes. I would say, the improvement in terms, the racial and ethnic relations. And now, this particular area, 60% of our residents is Asian. So, just like, the California, particularly Southern California, minority majority, and in a way, the Asians are, the majority. They are non-Asians are the minority in terms of number. Do Asians in Flushing area have enough power? Indeed, as the Joyce said, they were first elected officially in New York State, and now we got ourselves a congresswoman, and also the many of the Asian, both Korean and Chinese, officials there. And but our research is based upon the business. So predominant the owners are Asian, and the customers are of course is Asian, but there are quite considerable size of non-Asian the customers, and indeed we got ourselves you know, the ethnic tension. And I do have a privilege to, you know, to talk to one of the building owner. And he is a quite sophisticated, you know, the gentleman, own and manage the building more than 20 years. So I said some, you know, the when I ask certain question, he's, you know, the try to evade any actual, you know, the finality, which may or may not, you know, the have some, you know, the implication, you know, the race and racism. But he's, you know, the simply point out, does he ever had, you know, the, any applicant in his building for office use? He simply said, no, other people, that means other race and ethnicity, do not have no business here in downtown, you know, the Flushing. Interview was conducted in Korean, so there may be, you know, the slight, you know, the translation of, you know, the problem, but I tried to bring, you know, the nuance about, you know, his answers as best as I can. But yet, the other detail, he doesn't want to, you know, the engage, you know, that thing. I know it's really bad, but his building is right there. Four-story, you know, the black building. And try to, you know, to make sense of, you know, the taking picture of this big tall tree, you know, the kinder, you know, the view. And to me, in a way, this ethnocentrism, racism, you know, the issues, at least for, you know, the 8 months study, as, you know, my colleague, you know, point out, it's more likely ethnic enclave. And so, you know, the me versus some, you know, the someone else, that the mentality, you know, I just labeled as a tribalism, the place of, you know, the more, you know, the strong case. Yet, this is, you know, my ethnographic, you know, the data, which I like to share, you know, with you guys right now. So daily struggle between, you know, the Asian business owners and non-Asian customers. And so, you know, the there is a certain, you know, the level of, you know, the direct, the racism may play out. Later on, you know, the after the interview, I also thought maybe there's a sexism as well. But in case of, you know, the not in case, some, you know, the shoppers, client, customers, you know, said they are not comfortable to going into Asia, you know, the business. Because, you know, there's some things, you know, happen like this, when so-called dark-skinned customer walked in, and, you know, the owners and managers, you know, pointing out, and they're employed to follow them. And this is, you know, my field note, Doreen, and herself, you know, the name of, you know, the Black Caribbean from Barbados. And she actually said, I know what they're talking about me, you know, the, even though I don't speak Chinese. Because, you know, the, it's kind of daily interaction, you know, that she had been suffered through. And she precisely said, they are, you know, go after me because of my color of skin. And she doesn't want to, you know, the, take the picture front of, you know, the hall, but she let me take the picture in the back. So she's, you know, the pretend of, you know, to get into, you know, the, this shop. And this is, you know, the her clothing. And I am, you know, actually interviewed two gentlemen. You know, the one is a white American, also, you know, the light-skinned, and the other one is a Hispanic, you know, the gentleman. And they, their experience is quite different than Doreen. And they said, you know, it is a really good place to hang out, you know, best, you know, the restaurants, and, you know, the people are polite. And so, you know, the, it may not be, you know, the truly comparable just stop for the, the comparison here. But in one hand, Caribbean, the black lady versus, the too light skinned, the man experience is quite different. So, I just put it on, as an experience, my interpretation. So, during this research, I actually witnessed a few incidents, happens, the shop owner and the client, and, many of them, indeed, some negative, the interaction between, Asian shop owner versus white American client. Yet, as my, the informal interview, that's the, the only way to get this type of statement, it's, they exhibit, innate, the racist, the point of, or ethnocentric point of view, all black people are troublemakers. And, as I, said, this particular, the comparison between, the black female and, the white males, may, also play, some, the sexist, the ideas. Okay? And, in business reality, after, all those interviews, come to think of it, almost never, the business owner instigate that direct, the confrontation and, the ethnic incident. Because, their main, the purpose is selling their merchant and the services. And yet, they are sometimes, the victims of those bigotry. So, this is the, the one of the, the accidental, the key informant I come across, quite a character, the Jonathan, the African American guy, born and raised about, 5 miles from the downtown Flushing, place called Jamaica. And, the musician by training and his heart, but, he injured, his hand, playing hand, and, he quit the, the music. And, all those, the long, the colorful history, he also, said, quite an interesting, transformation for himself. He claimed, his ex-wife is Chinese, and, by, influencing, by her, he now practices, the Buddhism. Okay? And, these are the types of abuse and threat, business owner daily, the experience from, the customers. And so, there is a verbal abuse and threat, physical, the altercations, and, non-payment in certain services. And, the fact of, the second one, some people, they actually get injured seriously. Because, when they try to hold on, somebody, shoplifters and, someone, doing something illegal, try to hold them and, they are quite violently, the resist and has, the create, some physical, dangers. And, still, these neighbors suffer the, the many incident, anti-Asian, which happens just 3 years ago, 2015. These are, the picture. You probably almost, not able to, see. It was etched in, the water block, and it says, all you chinks go back to China. And, obviously after this incident, city councilman, Peter Ku, the investigation and the police precinct known as 109. That's the primarily the responsible for those neighbors had been the investigate, but so far as far as my knowledge goes instigator the offender have never been caught. And I do have some interview in a small law office, which consists of four the Chinese women, three the lawyers and one the law clerk. All of them past 12 months have some form of attack by the youngsters, primarily gang members, not necessarily all, African American or Latino kid. And in fact, all the statistics shows just like, any other, the gang activity in New York, in all of the, the United States of America, it reflects on, the ethnic competition. So, the gang membership known as 18th Avenue Crew, in that area, large number of Asian, the gang, the members. So, I don't quite, the grapple on whether it is part of a gang initiation, the right, or just, the local, the youngsters have fun for, harassing, the young, the Asian ladies. Either way, it is quite, I know, it's not, the large survey, but it's, the alarms me, when I, talk to this, the lawyers and, clerks in one office. And, as of last week, there are, the robbery, three, men crew, two Asian boys and one, the black kid, robbed another, the boy with the expensive, the sneakers. And, the two of the most, common, types of offense, by young people is shoplifting and vandalism. And, fact of, the Flushing area is considered as one of the safest, places. Just, the crime statistic is ridiculous in terms of how, the safe, the statistic, the record, the shows. Crime was down almost 2,000 points from the heyday of 1980, right now. But that doesn't reflect reality of everyday life. And I am, the interpreter, as both reasons are number one, the language barriers. The owners doesn't want, to deal with, the English, the reporting. And second is, the cultural practice. I don't want to involve with any authority. And the third one is, I'm too busy. The small stuff, just let it go. I have all the customers, waiting on line. And in fact, in one interview, store manager actually said, the reporting crime hurt his business. So this gentleman, the name Lo, and he, indeed, the hold, the one shoplifter, and, reported to the police. And even though it is just three blocks away, it takes about an hour to police arrive. And once, they come, and they start, they're asking questions, and, gathering the, the evidence, another hour. And, after 2 hours of this, the whole fiasco, and he said, during this period, he lost so many, customers. And second, is unconfirmed, the scientific, the observation. But as a store manager, he claimed, ever since that incident, he's reporting to the, you know, the police. Some regulars is not coming on, you know, the back. And he suspects maybe, you know, the customer doesn't want to, you know, the presence of, you know, the police forces. And this is the picture of a vandalized community bulletin board. And there are, you know, some limited, you know, the interaction between Asian and Hispanic. In fact, you know, this whole area have a huge, you know, the Hispanic, you know, the population too. And yet, due to the, you know, the fact we are doing the, you know, the business, you know, the research, most, you know, the Hispanic I able to, you know, observe. Was of, you know, the people who walk inside, you know, the Asian, you know, the stores. And practically daily basis, you know, the I saw, you know, the verbal abuse and, you know, the financial abuse toward, you know, the Hispanic worker employees. But at the same time, you know, as always, this interaction is not just one way. Some of, you know, the, at night, particularly, you know, at a Korean and Chinese owned bar, there are a huge, you know, the patron, in the, you know, the bars, happen to be, you know, the, Hispanic, you know, who work, you know, the nearby Asian store and, you know, the hotel. And also ladies use, cosmetic, you know, the stores, which is quite pricey. But, you know, the large number of, you know, those Hispanics, you know, the love, you know, the shop, cosmetic, you know, the beauty stuff from, you know, the Asian, you know, the shops. And during this, you know, the course of ethnographic, you know, the study, some of, you know, the quite intriguing, you know, the ethnic relations to come out. Koreans versus Korean Chinese, and Koreans versus Chinese, Korean slash Chinese versus Chinese. And the Korean Chinese, you know, the very quick, it's you know, the known as Joseonjo, in Korean community, that's a derogatory, you know, the remark. It's, you know, the people from, you know, the far eastern, northeastern side of China, Manchuria, border of, you know, the China and, you know, the Russia. And, in Korean community, they are vital, you know, the workforces due to the fact, you know, that they have bilingual, you know, the capacity. Yet, many of, you know, the Korean, you know, the Chinese, you know, the complaint, you know, the indifference or even direct ethnocentrism from, you know, the Koreans from Korea. And this, you know, the lady, you know, the, I know I got introduced by, you know, the one of my, you know, the friend. And, you know, the, she is a masseur. And she has, you know, the mid-40 and, you know, the working in, you know, the high-end, you know, the massage shop in Manhattan. And since she has, you know, the teenage, you know, the children, she, her, you know, the working, you know, the time is, you know, the less than, you know, the normal. So 10 hours, you know, in 6 days a week. And why, you know, we have, you know, the conversation several times later, she actually shows, you know, quite interesting tendency, say, against, you know, the Chinese. You know, now she's independent. She has a small, very small, tiny, you know, the massage shop in downtown Flushing area, not the corridor, you know, that we study, little further down, but, you know, she has a partner, Chinese partner, and yet she accused, you know, her partner doing illegal stuff behind her back. And, you know, the way she described is, oh, all Chinese doing those stuff, and it's their business. And the interesting of, you know, the way, I just, you know, the, show the few different massage shops, you know, the corridor, you know, that we study. This one is new. in first floor, which is really odd due to how much the rent the debt and the pay. And in business wide, there are the two tiers, okay, upstairs and the downstairs street level. Upstairs business is like stable, privileged, and even preferred. The second floor and third floor is also quite different. Second is primarily massage shops, massage parlor, hair salon, skincare, and tattoo. Yes, tattoo shops. And third and up is most likely professional office. And types of the professional office, as I share, the one of my key informant, law office, accounting firms, travel agencies, financial services, and medical office. And this, the Chinese law firm, the cases are so intriguing. And this had been almost 10 years. First term, the 2 terms, 2 year, the commercial lease, lawyer, had a lease. And, the annual interest, the rent increase is 2.5. And 2005, she realized, that ever going on, the rent is hurting her business. So she directly deal with the landlord and said, "Hey, my business is not as good as the used to. I cannot afford the $3,500 per month and keep on the increase every year 2.5%." So she said, "Give her a break." And the landlord agreed and the cut down the rent to the $3,000, and since then, almost 4 years, her rent is stable, the never increased, and it's month to month the commercial rent, and it's never ending the competition, but she's surviving, and she said one of the benefit in the Flushing area. With all those, the fierce competition. Still, you cannot beat up, any other play, the business wise, foot traffic, referrals, and, quality labor, which is another story, in our, the upcoming, the research. And disadvantage is obviously traffic, quality of life, and competition. And downstairs, this is the real sweatshop the atmosphere. I was lucky enough having some in-depth the interview with the restaurant owner, and it's just unbelievable. The small the office about 1,000 square feet. And she's actually paying $10,000 per month rent, and in aggregate the probably more. She doesn't want to reveal the exact number, but when you consider average price of her dishes is only $10-$15, the calculation is just impossible. How she able to maintain just the flow the whole business while selling $10-$15 the dishes. And this is the front of the restaurant. And I just want to show you this is the small joint, about 10,000 square feet, and in comparison to other buildings. Alright, so in the end, we got ourselves from doing some deep soul search. And why the Asians and the other immigrants come to the United States of America. And obviously it's the American dream. And while, you know, we can define, you know, the American dream as a many, you know, the different way, one of the, you know, the most outstanding idea is, you know, the search for the freedom. Okay, you know, the freedom for not to get, you know, the hungry and not, you know, able to find, you know, the next meal, you know, the political, you know, the, you know, the oppression. And yet, the definition of freedom, of, you know, the immigration community, in my point of view, are different than the popular, you know, the American, you know, the way to, you know, the look. In American society, freedom may, you know, the interpret as anything, you know, you want to do. But in, you know, the Asian community and many other, you know, the immigration community, I happen to have, you know, my, you know, the esteemed colleague from, you know, the Philippines. It's, you know, the freedom means free from the fear. And, you know, the death, you know, the fear factor, you know, the drive, you know, the Asian immigrant, you know, the working so hard, and at the same time, this freedom, you know, the collide with American value, and with different side of, you know, the American dream. And look, we are, educators, or, you know, the soon-to-be educator, and the way, you know, the we, you know, the have to deal with, the young kid, young generation, you know, the how they are, you know, the fear about their lives and, you know, the freedom of, you know, the taking away. So all in all, you know, the, we had a, you know, great, great, you know, the experience in this, you know, the research.
And before Claire goes over a summary of some of the things that we believe that the data that we've gathered thus far points to, I just wanted to mention a few other things. There was a fairly large Japanese-American population in Flushing at 1.2 up until about the mid-70s. And then they moved to an area that's known as Scarsdale, which is an affluent area further north in, the, in New York State. In addition to that, one of the things you see is that with respect to the small businesses, the competition is fierce. These businesses often are located on the same block and even within the same building as another business that does exactly the same thing. There's very little point of differentiation between these businesses, and therefore they compete on price. When they compete on price, it's a race to the bottom, and it's the person that has the deepest pocket that's going to outlast their competitor. So generally speaking, a new business will come in, and the way that they get the customer is by lowering their prices. The older business doesn't have the staying power. And so if you know this neighborhood and you know these folks, you realize what the turnover in those spaces really are. Since they took that snapshot, I would say there are at least 6 to 7 businesses on that block that are gone now. And they're either, the space is either empty or it has been replaced with a new tenant. The other thing you find is that because the rents are so high, in addition to having to try to survive in terms of the volume of business, the other thing is that there's lots of people that will rent a space and then what they'll do is they will sublet out little pieces of that space. Because somebody could afford $1,500 for a tiny kiosk, but he would not be able to afford the $10,000 that's required in order to rent a 1,000 square foot space. That works out on an annual basis to about $120 per square foot for that space. That rivals some of the areas in Manhattan. So business survival is very, very difficult. There's tremendous tension. And you'll see, for example, that many of the Asian businesses do hire Latino and Hispanic workers. And it's interesting, too, because there are many Asians that speak Spanish quite well. They've come through South America. I had one interaction where there was a Hispanic man that went into this food shop where I was trying to buy some roast meats. And he looked at something and he pointed it to it, and I said to him in English, is that what you want to buy? He said, yes, I like that, but I want him to chop it up. So I turned to tell the man behind the counter in Chinese what he wanted. And then the man answered him in Spanish. And then they went. They didn't need me as an interpreter. And so there is this really super dynamic inter-ethnic interaction. It is a major, major transportation hub. There are tremendous lines everywhere. The streets are very difficult to walk. And again, the local residents say that the place is crowded and dirty, etc., because the Asians have moved in. It isn't that. It is because they have made this a major transportation hub where you have buses that go all the way to the Bronx and to the outer surrounding areas and into Long Island. And with the amount of traffic that goes through there, there is likely to be dirt and grime and litter and so on. But the local residents have said that it is because of us. It isn't. It is because of New York City policies. Youngman mentioned Macy's, and I want to just be very specific about that. Macy's was an anchor store that they really wanted to keep in Flushing, in downtown Flushing. And as you notice, it is a mainstream store. There was a lot of complaints at one point that the names of stores were in Chinese or in Korean, and they wanted everything in English because it was a safety issue. They said that if it's in Chinese or it's in Korean, we don't know what kind of store it is. If there's a fire, the firefighters will not know what might be in that store. There might be chemicals, there are gas pipes, and this kind of thing. And I got up at a meeting at one point, and I said, listen, if I told you that the name of that store was Payne's, then what does that tell you about what is in that store? It isn't about English. If you have never been to the United States and you saw the store, the name Macy's, what does that tell you about what's in that store? So clearly there was a racial issue there, and then what happened was the Asian businesses would have the store lettering in their own language, but there would be an English title. For example, there would be something in Chinese or in Korean, and on the bottom we would say in English in smaller letters, barbecue restaurant. So that's how they got around that. But there are these kinds of issues. So Macy's was this big mainstream store, and they actually rerouted the buses so that buses would pick up in front of Macy's, which created tremendous foot traffic for Macy's. People going home would stop in Macy's, buy something, and then get on the bus to go home outside of downtown Flushing. On the other side of Main Street and Roosevelt Avenue, where there were many, many Chinese grocery stores, all those businesses disappeared because what would happen is the buses dropped people off in that area, which meant that people got off the bus and ran into the subways to go to work. They were not going to stop and buy groceries. When they're coming home, when they come up, they're not going to cross the street and go over to the other side to buy groceries. They're going to go to the side where they get on the bus to go home. So there were a lot of these kinds of things that were done without any input from the Asian American community, business community, or even residents in that area. But it was a very deliberate thing that was done. So I just wanted to give you a sense of the day-to-day flavor of what really happens in neighborhoods like this. You look at data, it tells you certain things, but it really doesn't get to the kind of the crux of what happens.
So what Joyce has just said is really important, actually, in terms of the context for what our data tells us. And this data that I'm finding that I have listed here are drawn from the in-person interviews that we did with the Youngman students and with Mitch as well while we were in Flushing. And sort of a condensed version of what this data is telling us is that, number one, and this was the most common sort of response we were getting from people that we had interviewed on the streets, and that they expressed a very deep desire for a greater diversity of ethnic businesses. And of the non-Chinese and non-Korean people that we interviewed, 22 out of 29 of the interview subjects actually specifically indicated that they wanted to see more ethnic businesses that reflected their own culture and their own heritage. And secondly, retail stores and restaurants were the most consistently frequented types of businesses, with the Macy's department store actually being the number one most identified business that was frequented consistently, along with other food establishments such as the food court in the New World Mall, and supermarkets and grocery stores as being the primary establishments that that individual were frequenting when they came to Flushing. And most respondents actually indicated that they regularly came to this block. They were coming at least once a week, which points to the sort of very consistent customer base that Flushing has established, which again means that there are implications for those individuals who are coming to this area and interacting with certain people and as a result having certain ideas develop out of those interactions. And fourth, individuals are also coming here for service and leaving. Sort of, you know, they're not really staying, and which means again that these interactions are happening, you know, sort of, they're happening not over, not the interactions that take place that essentially are going to be the primary experiences that individuals are having when they come to Flushing, because they're not, you know, sort of hanging out and you know, spending time in this area. And respondents who self-identified as a teenager within the 16 to 24 age range indicated they came to Flushing because of their school, which was located either in or near the neighborhood. And so for younger individuals, this area was kind of a socializing space, but for older individuals, elderly, middle age, they indicated they were simply just coming here and leaving. Many of our respondents they fell within a very wide and diverse spectrum of immigrant background, with some having moved to Flushing or to the neighborhood as little as a few months ago, just to others being here for I think one of our highest number was 49 years an individual had lived in Flushing, which again points to the diversity of the community that exists and is frequenting this area. And so the kind of, you know, the question that we then sort of are thinking about is, so what, and like, why does this matter, why is it important to us? And what our data is telling us and pointing to is that there are very specific businesses and centers and sites within this block that happen to have an immense amount of potential to shape and form ideas, whether that's racial or cultural or ethnic. And given the commercial and transit density of the strip and the frequency with which people visit, interactions are taking place within these businesses, and which means that it has an immense amount of potential to then inform individuals of how they think and how they perceive other people, which is what Young Men's data has shown, as well as Joyce and Mitch's own sort of background and knowledge of Flushing. And so, our then kind of next steps in thinking about how we want to proceed with this research is, what kinds of consistent suggestions can we develop, can we present to community boards or organizations that have a stake in these communities, and how can we then sort of help facilitate better and more effective and productive ways of communicating with one another, so that Flushing continues to be this, you know, very diverse and rich hub of culture, but also is a place that's welcome to individuals from all backgrounds and all walks of life.